Welcome to New Books in Poetry. I am your host, Jen Fitzgerald. When I first read our next guest's work, I was immediately taken to an unfamiliar terrain, not so much the landscape, but my guide to it. Ailish Hopper is the author of Dark Sky Society, New Issues Press 2014, selected by David St. John as runner-up for the New Issues Prize, and the chapbook Bird in the Head 2005, selected by Jean Valentine for the Center for Book Arts Prize. Individual poems have appeared in Agni, APR, Blackbird, Harvard Review Online, Plowshares, Poetry, Tidal Basin Review, and many others. Her essays on art and literature that deal with race have appeared in or are forthcoming in Boston Review, The Volta, and the anthology A Sense of Regard, Essays on Poetry and Race. A native of D.C., she lives in Baltimore and has received support from the McDowell Colony, Maryland State Arts Council, and YADO. She teaches at Goucher College in the Visual Art MFA program at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Welcome, Ailish.
Hey, thanks to be here. Thanks, Jen.
So as a native of D.C., it must be strange to see how rapidly and completely the city is changing. Can you tell us a little bit about the D.C. of your childhood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, strange is a good word for it. It's kind of science fiction, actually, to go back there, which, you know, I do a lot because I'm only an hour away. The D.C. of my childhood was really deeply segregated racially. I don't know the exact numbers, but the city was definitely majority Black in a big way, you know, not like 60%, you know, or 55, but like, you know, 80 something percent. So to me, it was very much a Black city. And that, you know, that phrase means something to me. It means something in terms of, like, you know, in my body, like music, food, a sensibility, a way of experiencing time and space, even, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's very obvious from your work that your life there has informed it. But could you explain a little bit about how growing up in that city informed your work as an artist now?
Yeah, you know, I think it was James Joyce who said, "When I die, Dublin will be written on my soul." Mm. And I mentioned that partly because my mother is from Ireland. And so, you know, there are a lot of DCs, and mine was not just informed by the, you know, the geography, this, you know, concrete place or whatever, but by the fact that I was raised by the woman I was raised by, you know, and then the things that happened to my dad. So it's kind of the whole thing. How it's influenced my work, I think. I think that there was something, you know, and I use this in the book in terms of kind of repeatedly referring to, like, insane asylums. I think there was this sense of insanity, like the sense of, like, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, or like seeing people having such completely different ideas about what life is, and like no idea of how disconnected they were in that way. That I think, not just growing up in the city, but being a young person, you know, things are like really clear to you when you're young, like, hey, that's wrong, you know, hey, that doesn't make sense. And I think, and that just sort of stuck with me. And, you know, sooner or later, these things that stick with you, they will out, you know, in your art.
Yeah. So if you don't want to talk about this, that's fine. But you did kind of in passing just say, you know, and what happened to my dad? And I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. And that's fine. And I'm fine. I mean, the chapbook really is all about my dad. So, you know, it's not a problem to be public about it. My dad was in the hospital when I was one and a half for an operation on his colon, and a bunch of mistakes were made, and he came out really profoundly brain injured. So, you know, I was like, whatever, two, maybe something like that, by the time he was home with us. So he was in and out of St. Elizabeth's, which is an actual, you know, institution, mental institution in D.C. And then he went to a kind of alternative institution in Virginia that, you know, existed to sort of not put people in front of TVs and dope them up all the time. But, you know, he did all kinds of, you know, he learned how to weave and like cook and do carpentry, and they ran it as a community, you know, and it was, you know, very cool kind of like utopian thing. So he wasn't, you know, in my house raising me probably after I was like seven. And I wouldn't say he was raising me when I was really little. Things were pretty messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for talking about that. I hadn't known. And now, the one poem is resonating in your collection. Is it The View from St. Elizabeth's, I believe?
Yeah.
That makes a lot more, sense to me now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is Baltimore, where you're living now, a city that is receptive to the arts? I haven't been there in about 10 years.
Receptive to the arts. Yeah. I mean, people talk a lot about what a great art scene there is here. I think that's pretty much true. It's still an affordable place to live, and there are a lot of great art programs. There's also an art college here, MICA. And so I think a lot of folks go to school and then stay. So they're it's a very livable place for artists. So there's certainly a lot of art happening. And it's a good place to make things. You know what I mean? There's not so much art biz that creates that kind of weird competition, you know, sort of commodification part. So, yeah.
I hope it can stay that way, because usually with places as wonderful as that, eventually commercialism comes in and changes it. I mean, look at Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's move into the poetry. Sure. I'd like to start with a longish piece. Would you please read The End of History on page 38?
Sure. The end of history. This beautiful, needful brain damage is like water seepage through computer circuits. Where the water goes, information disappears. But it can leave islands untouched. A synapse fires through unspoiled matter. He says, Finch, Finch, in words collapsed upon themselves. Says, Father, Father. And I imagine him then, preacher's tall son, wandering red clay paths, listening and looking up for small, quick shifts on branches. Two. Letter, the end of history. I don't know if I can read this one. It's very visual.
That's fine if you would like to move to mnemonic.
Yeah. Three, mnemonic. Sable for its face, cobalt for chest and wings, and ballpoint words spiraling around it as if its nest was going up in smoke. His full name, his wife's, his social security number, street address, telephone number of the house where they once lived. The rest, the vast, swan white, pocked and thirsty page, untouched. Draw a picture, they said, of all that you remember now. Four, letter, the right to code switch. Yeah, I think this is another one for me. It's like the ones that are really visual, it's very hard to read.
I'd love to make some of the text available online for sure.
I can describe it also just for folks who are listening, just that both of the letters use found text from his letters, and he had aphasia, so his language was like really deeply impacted by the brain injury, but he had a typewriter, and so he would write to me, and so I kind of used little snippets, which were frequently in all caps, and then combined it with scenes. Thanks, Ben.
I really loved this this piece, and I hadn't anticipated that you would try to sort through the more visual aspects, but it is the visual part that I was hoping to discuss next, because while there's many aspects of your poetry that I want to talk to you about, the organic movement and use of white space is what stands out, and I was hoping that you could speak a little bit about your process.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. A couple of folks have commented about the white space, and you know, of course, since I'm writing about race, there was a point, you know, where I was like, "Wow, there's a lot of white space here." A lot of the poems started out with a lot more, and I feel like part of my drafting process with the more complicated ones, complicated meaning that I was really aware that I was pulling in, you know, detritus from our culture and not just from, you know, my own personal sensibility or experiences. Mm-hmm. Part of the drafting was really just sort of going for pages and pages with a lot of space in between, as if like I needed, you know, with my mind's hands to kind of hold different parts of it separate and kind of sit with them a little bit. And then there was a kind of sifting maybe of those things, the hardest or maybe like more burning things kind of got sifted through and left on the page, I think. And I'm kind of a fan. I mean, less so, I think my work's evolving. It's probably more noisy now, but I began like the chapbook was very much about my dad and the formal problem of, you know, how do you write about communication that happens pretty much outside of language? I mean, you know, he would speak in like one or two word phrases. So there's a lot of charades and a lot of kind of gut feeling and the kind, you know, the kinds of communications we do outside of just words. And I liked the idea of like, well, how am I going to make something out of words, out of stuff that happens that, you know, never in words? So I think I became incredibly attuned to silence, both, you know, in life and also on the page. And then when I started to write about race, I started noticing like, wow, there's a lot of different kinds of silence. Like the silence of like, we don't know what to say and can't figure out a way to talk about this is a totally different silence than the silence between me and my dad when we would finally come to a hard won place of understanding.
That's something I've been exploring a lot in my own work. I've just been calling it writing the silence, trying to figure out what exists in those spaces between what we say and what we mean or what we say and what we say.
Yeah.
It's infinite, obviously, so that makes it a little difficult. But I also find that it's the same type of synaptic leaps that we make in poetry that we do in essay writing. And it's just, I think in poetry, we push it back up the page, and with essay writing, we pull it all the way down the page. So beyond the white space, a lot of your poems, they move organically. They move down the page. Trying to find one right now. In, you know, a counterintuitive way. So, you know, you will not only have the vertical white space, but the horizontal white space. Now, does any of this have to do with the ear of the poem?
The ear of the poem?
Yeah, like the way that you read it or want it read, or is this a much more cerebral space?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned those two things as distinct things. Like, I think my process, I think when I started writing poetry, I think by nature, I'm an ear poet. I write by ear. Mm-hmm. And I write with my body. And when I was first writing, you know, in high school and in college, my poems were so musical. But I was so frustrated with like how little meaning a little there, you know, there was in it. And it was a revelation to me when I started to figure out how to pull in, more meaning. And especially like, you know, I'm a pretty cerebral person. So it was hard for me to feel like those parts of me were two separate things. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know how musical the poems in the chapbook are. I don't think they're as musical. I mean, I think it's still a part of me, but I felt like with the race poems, I was able to play a little bit more with that. So it's a lot of times poems or lines of poems, they just emerge, you know, music and meaning together. Other times I might let the cerebral part lead, or I might let maybe like a gut or personal instinct lead, then revise it with the cerebral, meaning, you know, kind of like, wow, look at that. Because, you know, the thing about race is like, once you actually start pulling out these unspeakable things, what I noticed was there's a lot of things in there that I could critique. Mm-hmm. and say, wow, that's really ignorant. And how do I want to present that? Who do I want the speaker to be? Or, you know, so the cerebral would come into play in that way. And then for me, if it doesn't have music, it's not a poem. Just for me, I really need a lot of music in poetry. So then I would allow, really give like the musical self full rein to decide what got to stay and what got to go. And if it didn't hold inside the music, then it would have to go. And often the music would then lead me to a whole other kind of level of what I had just been doing.
Hmm. I love that as a revision process. It's really great. For the next poem, would you please read Home of the Quiet Storm on page 13?
Sure. So The Quiet Storm, for anyone who doesn't know, is a radio show that originated in D.C. And then it became so popular that clone versions of it popped up everywhere, which then resulted in lawsuits. And so people had to change the name. For instance, in Baltimore, it's called The Quiet Fire. but it was a radio show that I grew up listening to. Every night I would listen to the show. And so it was on a radio station in D.C. that's actually out of Howard University, WHUR. Home of the Quiet Storm. And the epigraph is WHUR-FM. Sounds like Washington. Yesterday, in the alley, a man was found, hair stringy, matted, hardening in the sun like mud, where dandelion and burdock rise, fill empty yards, and bind the wheels of soundless cars. Spilling from a pile of plastic bags, his body's a waste, my neighbor says, of a perfectly good white boy. But today, in the shade, young men buff and gloss, all around cicada song, in waves the way a breeze might come. High-pitched wail that almost drowns the radio. Just bees and things and flowers.
Thank you very much. So let's discuss the handling of race in poetry. I cannot think of any other white poet who allows race to enter into their work on the level that you do, which appears to be on race's term. So is this something that came naturally to you? Did you have to give yourself permission to do this? Did you have to, you know, I don't know how one would approach this subject in such an honest way. So help me out.
Yeah. You know, I feel kind of cagey sometimes addressing that kind of question. Because I'm aware that it's unusual, and I don't want anyone to interpret me as in any way an exception or some kind of exceptional person. You know what I mean? Like, But in terms of the formula, the ingredients that have gone into, you know, me asking the questions that I am or trying the things that I try, there's a lot. I mean, there's the fact that I grew up in D.C. And so I was immersed in the kinds of things that any, you know, racial minority is immersed in, you know, like being ignored, being misunderstood, being whatever, the kinds of things that activate a kind of self-consciousness around one's racialization. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that was going on. My generation, you know, I grew up at a time when, you know, the rebellion or AKA riots in LA happened, you know, Rodney King was beaten. And there was also like the OJ Simpson trial, which was a hugely racially divisive trial. Our mayor, Marion Barry, was arrested for smoking crack, sent to prison, then came out and was reelected, which was enormously divisive along racial lines. So I was watching my whole world be divided, you know, and they really were like two worlds. I mean, for me, you know, Langston Hughes, the two Americas. Well, you know, for me, very much, it was like the two dining room tables, you know, and ne'er the twain shall meet. So there's that. And then I think, you know, having my dad, we call it the accident, but my dad's accident happened, you know, I was so existentially attuned to what is possible in life, meaning bad stuff, you know, meaning that for no reason, things happen. And so these were like essential existential questions, like why do things happen, and why do people do this stuff to each other? And I mean, I think I was very, when I talk about where I'm from, I don't just mean sort of like DC. I mean, like when I say where I'm coming from, like my people, I probably identify more with like my dad or people who are vulnerable and in certain ways. So I was asking those questions. I went off to college. I was very lucky to get a scholarship to Princeton, and who should be teaching there but Cornel West. And so I signed myself up for African American studies classes because I wanted some answers. And that, you know, still is the case. I think the only place you're going to get the straight dope about race is in Africana studies. That's where people can break it down for you. So that was for me, like I could finally exhale and understand what was going on every level, you know, but both from my personal experience, but to me, that's really the least of it. But the bigger question of like this big machine that's at work that keeps producing the same reality for us again and again, like Groundhog Day. So that went on. So, obviously I got some good training there, I would say, I mean, not just him, but a bunch of other folks that were there. I think that's really critical. I mean, there are people that have studied this machine, you know, and they've studied how we behave and how we could behave differently, all that kind of stuff. So some of it is just education, I think, that if we're writing poems about race, but we're really only coming from our personal experience, that personal experience is important, but it happens inside of a context. And most of us, if we're in the racial majority, and it's not just a racial majority, we're in the positions of power in this country, we don't necessarily have an interest in learning about why the machine works the way it does, because, you know, maybe it benefits some of us or that kind of thing. So
we don't want to face how we benefit from it.
Exactly. And then the other thing I would just say is that I think I realized when I started writing the poems that this was really going to be a project about ignorance. And it took me a long time to write the book. I mean, I think really total, it took me 7 years. And I mean, I was working on other stuff at the time, but I also realized that these poems could not accommodate, I had, my two babies and I had, and I was like, now I can't put any, stuff in my marriage. it's like none of that stuff can go in this book, just very mutually exclusive in my mind for me to do race the way I needed to do it. And so I realized that and kind of was realizing in the drafting process, I mean, I wrote a lot of bad poems, and not just bad poems, like ignorant, like racially ignorant poems, because I have all that stuff in my head, just like anyone else. So the questions of how to make art out of ignorance, and art that also speaks to possibility, because I'm speaking as a privileged person, the skin privilege, I can't just write confession. It can't just be that. So I knew that, like, on every front, like as a poet, as a human, as a being, like I was going to have to be hanging out in a lot of not knowing and ignorance. So I feel it conditioned me to be pretty comfortable with that, I would say.
It's a good space to be. And it's a space where somebody can grow. Keats taught us hundreds of years ago, negative capability, be comfortable in a space where you don't know what's what, where you don't have to make a decision.
Exactly.
It's brave to do that. And it makes a lot of sense that your poems would resonate because, we write what we know, and this is your lived experience. And I think something that maybe separates not you personally, but people who are willing to confront this is, being the autodidact, going out there, teaching yourself, seeking out texts, because I find that so much resistance is met for good reason when people come from a place of privilege and want to have people who come from a place of oppression explain things to them.
Yeah.
Which is really not their job, right? Like, if we want to know about these things, there are many books. There are people who've been publishing for decades, and we can seek these things out.
Yeah. And I, the other piece is that, I joke that like now I'm race lady, you know, in all these different places, I'm pretty careful to think about it, but I know like most of my white friends know that like I'm going to rain on their parade, whenever I can. And so there's a, one of my favorite books, I think one of the most helpful and kind of brilliant books is Orlando Patterson's book about, it's called Slavery and Social Death. And it looks at slavery, like from not only cross cultural, but like sort of slavery practices throughout time. And so it enables us to look at slavery, which is where I started with race, was thinking about slavery, because I felt like, wow, this, like, I can't think of a way narratively to get into this thing. It's like rubber coated. It's got such a thick skin on it for how we think about it. You know, and there's just no originality possible. So I went back to his text and was thinking about it. And anyway, this notion of social death, that the slave is socially dead, is alienated from family, what he calls natal alienation, you know, this kind of stuff. Well, I think the person who's willing to confront race, and I think this is true at some level of all status quos, if they are status quos that really can threaten you, then you have to be willing to experience a kind of social death too. And I think there are ways that I now, in certain white spaces, if I don't disclose my racial politics, it's cool. People just assume, you know, but, mm-hmm. But there is a kind of social death. And I think it's a good thing. You know, I think it's the beginning of, you know, it's what bell hooks calls working and living at the margins. I don't like that because I want this to be moving ever towards the center, but it is there's a kind of death there. But I should also say, the second thing I want to say is that, I, you know, maybe because I grew up around a lot of Black folk, and so this is kind of cultural affinities in some ways, and just kind of ways of life or whatever. But I have some friends in my life, some friends who are people of color, with whom I have been able, you know, some of my deepest loves and deepest vulnerabilities and not knowing and learning together has happened not just with my white friends, although I've had amazing, you know, racial awakenings with my white friends, but also with friends of color, that these are conversations that I have had across difference, all kinds of difference, not just racial difference. And I could never have written this book, I think, if I hadn't. I knew all of the sort of forces and fears that would come up and would say, like, you can't do this. I mean, oh my goodness. And one of the poems has, it reports on this one conversation I had when I was at YADA with this older white male poet. He was like, oh, what are you writing about? And I was so naive. I'm like, race. I'm writing about race. And he gets this very puzzled look on his face. Now, mind you, he's in his 70s. Like, he was older, but he gets this, and then I could see the little light bulb goes off. And then he goes, oh, are you going to do the dialect? And I was just like, oh my God. And I left the dinner table and emailed this friend of mine. I was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to write this book. Like, this thing's going to be dead on arrival. This is like, you won't even know what I'm talking about, you know? So I think that what would kind of keep me going on, or I would get rejected by journals. Everybody gets rejected by journals, but I did feel like sometimes, like, this is a poem that they would want if it wasn't so baldly about race. If I was writing a more elegiac kind of, or writing about the civil rights and not about like how awkward it is with my neighbor right now, you know, I felt like they would maybe take it, you know. And I mean, this is maybe also my paranoia, but at those moments when I would feel that capital D doubt, it was the fact that I knew that in real life, off the page, I know what's possible. I know it in my body. And so that would keep, that's really the blood flow, the real blood flow of the book in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, this conversation can now go in about 83 different directions. I'm trying to find the one that can stay most concrete. So I think that when a person comes from a place of difference, they see more clearly many other differences. So I too have had experiences with, I'd say mostly people that are not of means and people that are of color. I tend to have the most understanding of how the system or any system really operates. Mm-hmm. And I agree that the journals that we consider to be the gatekeepers like to play it safe. And I don't know whether that has to do with not wanting to offend people, or the fact that anything that is seen as social or political is immediately marginalized as, like, you know, a knee-jerk reaction. And I don't know if those two are inherently connected.
So we're going to go there now, huh?
Well, we don't have to. That's okay. I got two more poems for you to read. We can skip all this.
No, I mean,
I mean, this is the part of it that's very, very hard for people to get, because it's like I frequently teach that, whatever, that graduation lecture that David Foster Wallace did, where he talks about the two fish walking around, you know, and the one fish is like, what the fuck is water? Like, you know, it's, and I also share that experience. Like, for me, race is very much bound up in class. I went to a private school in DC because my mom was the secretary there and I got to go for free. And it was like mind blowing for me, the kinds of houses I was around. I mean, I just don't even know if I would have experienced those two dinner tables. I mean, I really experienced two different dinner tables, you know. And then Princeton, you can just imagine. I actually left Princeton for 2 years because I was like, just, you know, what is this place? You know, I felt like, why do I need this planet? And was convinced, I was waiting tables and was convinced by my regulars who were like, you need to go back there and get that degree. But I think that the publishing world and poetry in the U.S., because it's very much about the U.S., you know, maybe the U.K., it has an aesthetic, and the aesthetic serves an agenda. I mean, it benefits, do you mean somebody? And, you know, I see it around race and also poems that address that, anything that addresses the power structure. If it's threatening, it has to be threatening in a particular way. Whereas in other cultures and at other times, the poet was really conceived of as someone that was there for that. The poet was really the conscience in a lot of ways. These are huge generalizations. Like, there's plenty of effete poets, you know, in other places, you know, who are pets of power, you know what I mean, with the diamond collar and the pretty pillow to sit on. So, you know, there's all kinds of poets, but I do think that there's a way that, and the publishing world is really bound up in the education world and all those things. And that's why I thought Jeswinder's essay that we were looking at Facebook on was really nailed it, that there's a culture in the academy, and that's very similar to the culture in the sort of establishment publishing worlds. And it's a culture. It has, you know, favorite ways to behave and forbidden ways to behave.
Absolutely. I am pretty candid about the fact that I came from a very poor background and haven't entirely emerged from it. But when I went to my MFA program, I was caught off guard with how in the minority I was as a person who wasn't of means, because I believed the whole meritocracy. I was like, oh, okay, so if it's based on merit, then the amount of the population that is represented by poor folks will be represented in these programs, because their, you know, talent is spread evenly across all races, classes, and genders. But no. That wasn't the case. And it was definitely a very quick lesson that I had to pay attention to. And I immediately started to put my accent into check, because, you know, after a drink or two, my Staten Island comes out raging.
Right.
And it was that idea of being conscious of myself that made me really uncomfortable, because I, by nature, I am an observer. And when I am aware that I am being observed, I fall apart.
No, the thing you mentioned, though, about politics, though, I mean, the thing that I think is fascinating about all of this is, you know, everything happens in code. And so, and as soon as you can, as soon as you get your little decoder ring for power, it's like, oh my God, this is so easy. Look, you just said X, but you totally meant Y. And I guess, like, the question about, like, politics or political poetry, that kind of stuff, I find it interesting from an aesthetic perspective. I think it's interesting as someone, I'm a maker, you know, and I'm a thinker too, but, like, I think it's fascinating to think about it from the, like, what are the, like, there are certain poems that are acceptable, and they also point at injustice. You know, they also point at power and excesses of power and things like that. But then there's some way that they don't actually sort of shake things up. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the difference between the ones that do and don't are aesthetic differences. They're questions of making. I mean, these could be two people with the exact same politics, right? It's a question of, like, what kinds of work they're doing on the page. And so for me, I think it's funny that essentially all of the critiques of political poetry are on the grounds of aesthetic inferiority, right? So it's like, you're didactic, you're thematic, you have an agenda, all that kind of stuff. And
there are poems that just suck, and that those are like totally plausible claims. But I think there's something else there that I find just fascinating as a maker. Like in the next book that I'm working on now, one of the things I noticed about writing about race is that to write about race is actually to write about possibility. It's not only to write about injury. Mm-hmm. Injury is the allowable story, but the harder story is to talk about what's possible. And we have King and the dream and that kind of stuff, but really we read that as pretty utopian. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think it serves power to always be talking about political poetry as wrong for its ideas when the whole thing is still also about poetry.
Yeah, and if we didn't deter people from being thematic, maybe they would have the ability to leap over that into where they really want to be, whether it be like the language poetics or, you know, alluding to something instead of referring to it.
Yeah, good point.
All right, so this is a good transition for us to move to your next poem, which I hope you'll read for us, Ways to Be White in a Poem, on page 32.
Okay. Yeah, so this was at the aforementioned school. Ways to Be White in a Poem. Tension makes a form resound, and so the many lines I am told not to cross. Do not go out alone at night. Do not call attention to yourself. Closer to the color line, the more I am white girl fool. It is a while before the other girls correct me gently. Good timber needs more air. Shout out. Muscles flex, quick shift. I stomp. Impious, impervious now. Do not dance suggestively. Hold a stranger's eyes. That first day in the gym, I asked the row, could I, thinking about cheers, elbows sharp, foregrounded, feet cloud stepping, never of a cheer as the body went up, as if I were not. Branch creaking, rope taut. And maybe you too, whoever you are, reading this, flicker. Do not touch or eat their food. Do not drink from the same cup.
Thank you. I love this poem very, very much.
Thank you. That poem's been rejected by every journal in the whole damn country.
And you know what? They're all regretting it now. So there you go. So in what ways, if at all, is this piece speaking to or with Thomas Sayers Ellis's Ways to Be Black in a Poem?
I don't think the poem is. I think his title, of course, I don't want to get into Thomas's work, but the joining of the word ways with the name of a race, that it's an activity. It's not a property. Mm-hmm. So that set me thinking, and I think in a lot of ways, I'd say the whole book is about ways to be white. You know, you could think about that as like a subtitle for my book in some ways, about the activity of it, whether it's the activity, you know, in my interiority or the activity inside of my interpersonal relationships or the activity that's around me, you know, compressing me or, you know, or lifting me up and someone else down, that kind of thing. But so that was sort of the start. And there were a lot of different versions of this. And I finally allowed myself to write about this, that, you know, that is a true thing that happened. It's an actual thing that happened, I should say. And that was hard for me to write about. So, because it just felt really confessional.
Yeah. This poem was an example of what I thought of your poem moving organically through the page, because it does kind of sway and has almost like a wave type motion. Now, is this something that you write towards, or was this something that just came out during the revision process?
I think that that's part of what I mean by music, that there
when the poem is happening inside me or coming through me, it's often sort of many strands, let's say, happening at once, different musical lines, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get them on the page and then try and work with them so that the page reflects what I'm hearing. And that one, that's definitely how it happened, you know? I think the anecdote that's at the center of it got told in a couple of different ways, you know, in the drafting of it. And so I ended up settling on particular aspects of it that was based on pieces of language that I liked and that fit with the other strands, like that series of do not do this, do that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So for the last poem, would you please read To Ignorance on page 89?
Yes. And so I should say about this is there's a little visual piece where in a train station, you know how they list the destinations and the words for the places are kind of, they're in all caps and they're cut off. To ignorance. Entering Penn Station, I see a man, hands tracing the slats of a wooden bench. But I keep moving, think, he's all right, as departures, Vermo, Harris, revolve, cascade, at track number 5, stops in. Then I notice his body's still waving, invisible, the current, thimbleful of junk, steady swimming in his bloodstream. Today, someone asks why I am writing about race. I look up at the ceiling's false sky, tall shapes, fatal as hope. I have, I say, a gentle answer and a tough. Which do you want? My head's already hurting with memory, like the time I called by his first name, my professor, who was black. Or when someone asked about my poems, if I would do the dialect, he chooses tough. And I say, actually, that one, you have to learn for yourself. The station glitters with windows dark. How do I look? I say to my reflected self, keep moving, says a voice that disappears so quickly. It is as if it was never there at all.
Thank you. I had no idea how perfect this would be based upon our conversation to end with this. I wanted to end with it because there's a sense of finality in it. It is as though it closes off experience and moves into the realm of the self. And I don't know if that's how it was crafted, but this is one of my favorite poems in the collection.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think that I'm not going to drag you through any more quagmires of any of it. So I want to thank you, Ailish, for your time and for sharing your work with us and for speaking so candidly with me. It was really wonderful.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for asking me.
This is Jen Fitzgerald with New Books in Poetry, reminding you to support all the arts, but especially poetry.